time since David stood. If calculated, the combined gross payroll of the assembled executives would be staggering. All now stared shell-shocked at the man in front of the room. The man in charge. The man wearing the black leather jacket. Brock leaned forward, looking ready to lead Dave out of the room to have a quick talk. Instead, he took a breath and waited. Dave glanced down at the floor, then again over the crowd. His odd monologue, his peculiar demeanor, was finally causing his boss to shift and fidget. "The thing is, though, I can't continue this way, without knowing, with nothing changing. I just can't." Dave's shoulders slumped, as if the weight of his words was becoming too much to carry. "I had another good friend who I could tell all of my problems to, all of my concerns. And the thing is, she was always able to find me an answer. I've always wanted to grow a ponytail, buy a Harley, and ride across the country." "A Harley? Like a motorcycle? In your suit and tie?" "No, of course not. I'd get a black leather jacket, and I'd ride across the country until, well, until I came to the Golden Gate Bridge. And not just to it, I'd ride across it. Across the bridge. Yep, it would be the 4th of July. The sun would be shining, the sky would be bright and clear. A slight breeze would be blowing over the ocean and through my hair."
"Dave, are you okay?"
Brock was standing now beside him. Ellen had jumped up as well. Dave gazed at Brock and then out across the room before focusing on his jacket. Worry rolled across his lips.
"What's today?" he asked.
"What?"
Brock replied.
"Is today the 26th?
Dave turned to the crowd as if asking a school class. The intern, a guy who had come to watch a master at work, spoke up first.
"It's the 26th, Mr. Riley."
26th, Dave repeated, doing the math in his head. Brock touched his shoulder and pushed him towards his empty chair.
"Dave, why don't you take a seat and let me take over here?"
Dave's tone shifted, quickened.
"There's still time. I can make it."
"Still make what?" Ellen called out.
If Dave heard his boss's question, he didn't respond. Instead, he turned to Sean Safford.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Safford. Brock will explain the study. I have to go."
With that, he sidestepped around Brock and bolted through the conference room door. Chapter 26. Dave followed Red through the back doors at Lakeshore until both men stood beside the 91 Sturgis that Dave had ridden to Frederick. It was polished and ready. As they looked the bike over, Red spoke first.
"She's all fueled up and clean as a new diapered baby."
"Thanks, Red."
"The boss will want you to sign this."
Red picked up a sales contract that waited on the counter and handed it to Dave.
"I'll take care of the rest of the paperwork."
Dave scribbled his name on the dotted line without reading a word.
"You know where you're heading?"
Red asked. "I've known for a while. It's a bridge my grandfather helped build. I visited once as a boy, when I was 7 or 8. I barely remember it. We went out as a family for my grandfather's funeral. It's funny because I don't really remember him, my grandfather. Yet I have a curious recollection of staring up at these massive orange spires on the bridge, as if they were enormous fingers that reached up to touch the clouds." There was a long pause before Dave spoke again. "I also remember my father telling me, very distinctly, that my grandfather found answers at that bridge." Dave took another breath.
"I don't know if I ever told you, Red, but Megan bought me this jacket before she died. It's hard to explain why I need to go. I just do."
Dave, I'm the one guy you don't need to explain that to. Just be prepared. You need to realize that the answers you find may not be those you expect.
I'll keep that in mind. And thanks for teaching me to ride. Being my friend. Everything.
No problem.
Listen, you've got my number if anything comes up.
I do.
Red pressed a green button on the wall, and the metal overhead door clanked into action. Dave pushed the bike outside, threw his leg over the seat, and engaged the engine. He raised his hand toward Red, a mixed gesture of thank you and goodbye. He couldn't hear Red's reply over the rumble, but he could read his lips. Godspeed. Dave twisted the handle, released the clutch, and rolled smoothly out of the parking lot while Red watched the bike and his newfound friend disappear. On his way home from Bike House, Dave stopped at REI and purchased a sleeping bag that he stuffed into his bike's leather saddlebag. He didn't plan on using it. It was only for emergencies. He'd been a camper as a teenager, but that felt like a lifetime ago. Camping to Megan, after all, meant a weekend at the Marriott. At home, Dave gathered up the rest of his essentials. Clothes, toothbrush, toothpaste, a handful of power bars, two bottles of water, a cell phone, and his printed maps, just in case. That morning he'd spent more than an hour on the computer calculating the mileage, days, the stops along the way. He had plenty of time. Even with stops for food, gas, laundry, and sleep, he would still make the Golden Gate with at least 2 days to spare before the 4th of July. Two lights were left on, the front and back porch. It wouldn't matter. He lived in a secure neighborhood. He glanced around one last time, wondering if he'd forgotten anything. The newspaper had been stopped. He'd put a hold on the mail. He'd called two boys on the baseball team to keep up the yard. They were more than happy to oblige. The security patrols had been notified that he would be on an extended vacation. It was time. Once in the garage, Dave locked the door leading to the house, then wheeled the bike out into the driveway. He checked the latches on the saddlebags for the third time. They were fine. Then entered the garage code. He watched the door drop until the bottom rubber edge pushed tight against the pavement. It felt symbolic. A door being sealed behind. Uncertainty opening ahead. He took a breath, swung his leg over the bike, and pressed the ignition. It roared to life. With the clutch engaged, he clicked the machine into gear and twisted the handle. His action was still not as fluid as Red's, still not as certain, but it was adequate. Though he'd vowed not to look back, he couldn't resist a final glance as he rolled toward the street. At the mailbox, he squeezed the brake to bring the bike to a stop and check traffic. The sun was just beginning to set, causing a glare from the west. He wouldn't get far tonight. But he was leaving anyway. He couldn't stay another night in the emptiness alone. With the sun in his eyes, it was difficult to make out the shape of the car coming down the street toward him. The sound, however, was unmistakable. He waited for Brock to pull in front of the mailbox, shut off his ignition, and step from his car. Dave turned off his engine as well, then watched Brock study him. First the bike, and then the scene before him.
"Looking good. Looking very good," Brock finally said.
"Thanks.
I mean the bike, of course. The real question is, are you okay?"
"I think so." Dave kept his answer short. He waited for Brock to get to his point.
"You sure you want to leave like this?"
Dave responded with the slightest of shrugs. Brock continued.
"You're kissing off a six-figure-a-year job. I'm sure that's filled with some terrific irony or hidden meaning, but I sure as hell don't know what it might be."
"Look, I know it doesn't make sense. I just need some time off, that's all."
"Time off, huh?" Brock questioned.
"Yeah."
"Are you sure? 'Cause it sounds like a bit more than that."
"No, I'm not sure at all. It just feels right. Feels right? Weird, I realize, but yeah.
Brock accepted the answer, seemed to understand that nothing he could say would dissuade the man.
It's not going to be the same at the office without you.
I appreciate that.
How did Ellen take it?
Brock's eyes rolled heavenward.
She went ballistic, threw the reports across the conference room, swore up a storm, not in front of Safford, but before the elevator doors had finished closing. Yes, I'd say you did a fine job of burning that bridge to a crisp. Even if you changed your mind, the truth is, it's probably too late for you to come back.
She'll get over it.
Perhaps, Brock said. And I also talked to Dr. Jaspers today. She said you weren't answering or returning her calls.
She means well.
She asked if I'd have you call her.
In time.
So, where are you heading?
West. There's a bridge my grandfather helped build.
The Golden Gate?
Same one.
You're not going there to jump off, I hope.
The remark caused Dave's first smile.
I hadn't looked at it that way.
Well, don't.
I'm sorry I brought it up.
Dave exhaled, sucking in a fresh breath. Tried his best to explain.
I remember hearing a lot of family stories about the bridge, mostly concerning my grandfather. They say he found answers there. I just thought I'd go have a look.
That sounds quaint.
Brock's tone reeked of ridicule. Dave ignored it.
It's what he believed.
When will you get there?
By the 4th. I have a stop to make first, but I'll still make it by then.
Each out of words, the silence settled around them, then nudged. Brock extended his hand. Dave reached out and clasped it to pull his friend close.
For the record, Brock added, I think you're crazy as hell. But at the same time, good luck.
Thanks.
And I am going to try to smooth things over with Ellen. So if you get to the bridge and it's closed or something, call me.
Dave nodded, pulled on his helmet, started the bike, and then reached for the clutch. Before squeezing it tight, he raised his hand in a stationary wave. Brock reciprocated. A quick shift, a gentle rumble. Brock turned left. Dave turned right. Brock toward home and Dave toward the lingering glare of the setting sun.
Chapter 27. Upon my return to the library, I find a note by a man named Alfred Finilla. I was walking on the catwalk and I slipped my watch into my pocket. It was a gold pocket watch. I missed my pocket and the watch went down my pants leg and kept going all the way down into the water. It gave me a funny feeling. I understood how he felt. Another man, Peanuts Coble, noted, Ed Reed was a full-blooded Indian who boxed professionally on weekends. I was boarding with him at an old widow lady's place in Sausalito. Ed was sometimes a bit short on manners. We were eating with the widow and her kids at the table when she said to Ed, Don't you feel proud that someday your son or daughter will look up at that bridge from a cruise ship and say, My father helped build that? With a mouthful of food and without missing a beat, Ed responded, Just so the little bastards don't say I fell off of it. When I laugh aloud, Gwen the librarian wanders over to find out what is so funny. She reads the account and her smile lingers. I hope you find what you're looking for. Thank you, I say. But my frustration must show, because no sooner have the words come out than she continues to probe. Are you sure I can't help you find something? I'll take all the help I can get. Gwen, I say, I'm looking for information about a man named Patrick O'Reilly who worked on the bridge. I was hoping to find something here, but no luck. Any ideas? Did you check the electronic index? Yes, nothing. And you've checked some of the better histories written about the bridge? Yes, and again, nothing. She lists a few more ideas, but none that I haven't tried. We do have some material out on loan to two or three other universities. I can check the log and see what turns up. Did you say the name was O'Reilly? Patrick O'Reilly. I thank her kindly, but my chances are slim. Thousands of men worked on the bridge. Thousands made their contributions, put in their years, and then filtered out into the vastness of America. I am hoping for the impossible. As Gwen wanders away, I continue to read stories of struggle, lessons of triumph. I find words of sorrow in the histories, but also words of accomplishment. I read about the men's lives, and I wonder about their families and how their wives and children left at home must have worried. Did these men have their own Annas? The information is captivating, but the lights dim, and the library will soon close for the day. And I have yet to see the name of Patrick O'Reilly. It appears he arrived out of nowhere, dedicated a good 5 years or more of his life to the bridge, and then dropped off the face of the earth. I call the professor early and tell him that I'll be at home working on the project. I don't dare tell him that means I'm obsessed with learning more about Patrick and Anna. I came up empty at the library, but bumps in the road are expected. I begin today by calling the Golden Gate Bridge Highway and Transportation District, the agency that was formed to finance and construct the bridge. They were slated to disband once the bridge was complete and the construction bonds were repaid, but, like most government agencies, they proved harder to dispatch than to organize. While they once managed construction of the bridge, today they oversee all transit in the Golden Gate Corridor. I talk with three people before confirming what I already suspect. There are no employee records that cover the building of the bridge. I'm reminded that they only oversaw the work of hired private companies. Next, I attempt to track down records from the contractors themselves. There were 10 prime contractors and various subcontractors selected to work on the structure. To my dismay, none are still in business. The room's air is beginning to smother me. It's time to take a walk. I open the journal and scribble down the address Patrick has written on the inside cover. It is in Parkside, a good 5 miles from where I live. I change into my jogging shorts, lace up my running shoes, and head out the door. I picture finding an old apartment building, historic but well-kept, a place where a friendly elderly gentleman in the office talks about the workers they once housed during the construction of the bridge. He'll speak of being but a small boy, perhaps 5 or 6, when his father or grandfather owned the building, and he'll still remember the men. He'll confirm that, of course, they have all their records from over 80 years ago, that they're kept in an old wooden filing cabinet upstairs in the attic. He'll tell me to help myself and to lock the door on my way out. Or even better, he'll tell me that, though he was just a lad, he recalls a charming Irish gentleman in particular. It's a good vision that keeps me running. But when I arrive at the address, I find a supermarket. I contemplate jogging back home, but I flag down a cab instead. My wall is getting taller, wider, and deeper. In research, you climb over, you dig under, you find a hole. It's a matter of time, persistence, and patience. Where is the weakness in my wall?
Ellen reclined in her deep leather chair, her feet squarely on the desk. It was a position she seldom took. Her stare was at unseen objects out the window, past the city skyline. "Damn him," she grumbled to herself. "How could he just get up and walk out like that?" With no one by Ellen's side to bob their head along with hers and agree that she was right, she cursed again for good measure. Just to feel better. The woman wasn't through ranting. Dave knew how important this account was. How could he do it? It wasn't easy being the boss.
especially of a company where her father had once been in charge. Ellen wished she could be sympathetic, but she had a business to run. Dozens of people depended on her for their paychecks. Not just Dave Riley.
And to not wait until the meeting was over, she continued. To leave right in the middle with the client sitting there in shock.
It was unacceptable. There was a line of common sense, of decency, a professional demeanor. Dave Riley hadn't just stepped over it. He'd taken a running long jump. The familiar beep of the intercom startled her. She pulled her feet in and sat up straight in her chair.
Miss Brewer?
It was her secretary, Kathy.
Yes, Kathy.
There is a call for you on line 7. It's Mr. Jim Weisenberger.
Weisenberger? Weisenberger. Ellen repeated the name. It sounded familiar, but she couldn't place it.
Kathy, do you know who he's with?
Kathy's tone echoed surprise, since usually her astute boss recognized the names of such important men.
It's Mr. Jim Weisenberger, the CEO of Bike House Customized Motorcycles. He's calling from Wisconsin. He needs to speak with you right away. He says it's urgent.
Chapter 28. My first call of the morning is to Janet Metcalf, a friend in Salt Lake City. After getting a history degree from SFSU, she moved to Utah to work for an insurance agency. I call her first because she's an avid genealogy nut, and I use the term in the nicest sense of the word. The Mormon Church operates a family history library there that is one of the best in the world. I know that Janet uses it regularly to research her own ancestors, and I'm hoping that she'll know the ropes and use it to help me. Good morning, this is Janet.
Janet, it's Katie Connolly.
Katie, it's about time you called. How are you? We chat for several minutes, catching up on old acquaintances and gossip. I find out that she's engaged. She finds out that I am hardly dating. She loves her new job and is surprised to hear that I'm still working at the university. She and her fiancé are planning a trip to Hawaii for their honeymoon. I tell her that for my vacation, I painted my house. Before I get too depressed, I cut short the small talk and get to the reason for my call. Listen, Janet, I'm calling to ask a favor.
Sure, what is it?
I'm looking for a man. I pause at the wrong moment, and she jumps in before I have a chance to finish.
Well, it's about time. You came to the right person.
I know several who are available. Let me rephrase that. I'm looking for information about a man. He lived in San Francisco from about 1931 to at least 1937. His name was Patrick O'Reilly. I was thinking that since you're so good at genealogy research, you could check the family history library for me.
I'd be happy to. Do you know when he was born?
I don't.
You don't know how old he was?
No, not exactly.
He was from San Francisco, though?
No, I don't think so.
A U.S. citizen?
I doubt it, but I don't know.
So all you really know is his name?
Pretty much.
I do know that he had a wife whose name was Anna. At least, I think they were married. I know they loved each other. She was living somewhere far away, perhaps Ireland.
I was hoping that you could look for him in both San Francisco and Ireland.
Let me get this straight. You want to find a man named O'Reilly from Ireland, and that's all you know about him?
I guess.
Should I look for a Smith from the United States while I'm at it? If she is trying to make me feel stupid, it's working.
I know it's not much, but it's all I have right now, I admit.
It'd be easier to just find you a man.
I called because you're the best researcher I've ever known.
You know me, Katie. Flattery will get you everywhere.
You say his first name was Patrick?
You'll give it a shot?
Sure, but no promises. Now, is there anything else you can tell me about him? Anything else at all? He may have been an engineer or attended engineering school. Does that help?
About as much as knowing his favorite color, but it's something. I appreciate this. Just promise you'll come to my wedding. It's a promise. I confirm my address and say my goodbyes. I hate to admit it, but Janet is right. I need more information. Before I make any other calls, I pick up the journal, open the cover, and carefully turn page after page. There must be something I've missed.
The steel and concrete buildings blurred as Dave headed south, away from the city, away from the job, away from Brock and Dr. Jaspers and Ellen Brewer, away from his empty home in Jamesburg, away from the memories. There was one visit he needed to make before his journey to the bridge could begin. One place he felt compelled to see. Traffic in Washington, D.C. was heavy when Dave arrived, just as it had been every other time he'd ever been to D.C. Once, 3 years earlier, feeling guilty for not providing enough culture for the children, he and Megan had piled the family into the van for a long weekend in the nation's capital. They'd made plans to see all the historic sites, the Washington Monument, the Jefferson Memorial, the Constitution Gardens, and, yes, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the wall that Red so deeply revered. Unknowingly, however, they'd picked the same weekend as the annual Cherry Blossom Festival, the time each spring when the trees blossom and the crowds throng in hordes to see. By the time they'd hit Constitution Avenue, traffic had come to a standstill. After moving only 2 blocks in 45 minutes, the family voted to bail. They would get historic another time. Instead, they opted for Annapolis, one of Dave's favorite getaway spots. They rented rooms at the Prince George Bed and Breakfast and spent the weekend going to movies, restaurants, and even a wax museum. Those were good memories, but also reminders that the city's historic sites remained on the someday list. Today was the day. Dave found a parking spot along Henry Bacon Drive and locked up his bike. It was a short walk to the monument nestled in the grassy park of Constitution Gardens. His pace slowed as he neared the structure. It was exactly as Red had described it. Black granite panels, arranged into 2 arms that extended to form an angle. The area sloped gently toward the center of each, so that a person entering at ground level, the descent toward the middle would reveal more and more of the wall. At the highest point, Dave guessed the wall extended about 10 feet. He studied the design. It was striking, but unimposing. Less grand than he'd imagined, and yet certainly profound. Each of the long black granite slabs sunk down into the earth, obviously symbolic of the men and women who had died and were buried. And it was indeed a place of calmness and serenity. Dave stepped back to record mentally what he was seeing, feeling, if not for himself, then for Red. Most staggering were the sheer numbers of names cut into the stone's surface, thousands upon thousands of names, each holding a story of lost life, love, and legacy. An older, olive-skinned man and woman shuffled past Dave toward the wall. They were speaking Spanish. As they neared the granite, their tones hushed. The old man bowed his head and looked down while the woman raised her hand, extended her wrinkled finger, and touched a name. Farther down the wall, Dave watched 3 teenage girls, one writing in a notebook, while the other 2 strolled silently back and forth. It was more hallowed behavior than one might have expected from teenage friends on a beautiful summer day. Dave stepped up to the granite slab, picked a name at random, and let his fingers trace the letters. Clifford Paxton. Who was he? Who had he left behind? Dave's fingers moved to the name adjacent. Simon Ellison. Did he leave a wife? Did loved ones still visit and trace outlines of his name? Was he still remembered? Books had been placed at each end of the wall that listed the soldiers alphabetically, making it easy for friends and family to find their loved ones. Dave walked to the book
flipped through its pages, searched for Leslie Harris, and then located the panel where his name was engraved. Dave let his fingers trace the furrowed letters, as Red had done so many years earlier, and no doubt many times since. But what about the soldier's name below Leslie's, or the one above? Every single one, like Leslie, had given his or her life, had left grieving family behind. While he was grateful for the chance to touch Leslie's name, to remember Red's story, to offer a silent moment of gratitude for the man's sacrifice, Dave also realized that each and every name would do. He had read about the war in school, recalled the history. Countless books and movies had been written and made, and he had read and seen many of them. Yet it had never felt like his war. An elderly woman approached and placed a flower at the base of the wall. Dave could see no tears, and yet she touched the wall with reflection. What was her story? Had she lost a friend, an uncle, a father? He thought about approaching her, asking, but didn't. Instead, he bowed his head, closed his eyes, and offered a tribute to those whose names stretched out before him. To Les Harris, to thousands of faceless others, and to Red. He was thankful he had taken the time. It was a hallowed place, a sacred place. Red would be proud. And yet, although he knew he would never take the war for granted again, he also realized this was not where he would find closure. Without looking back at the woman, the teenage girls, the couple, or the many others who had come to pay their respects, Dave turned and walked back across the grass and down the street to where his bike was parked. Many came to the wall to shed tears. Dave did not. Instead, he strapped on his helmet, climbed on his bike, and rode, away from Red's answer, and toward a search for his own.
Chapter 29. As I study the journal again, combing for clues, I find something new. Patrick wrote, "When Russell Cohn came to inspect me work on the cable, we discussed how the bridge moves and deflects as the cable length changes. 'Tis this giving of the bridge that gives strength to the structure and absorbs strain. My bridge is almost a living, breathing thing." I find his comment intriguing, for as a child, I also imagined the bridge to be alive. With the wisdom of years that adulthood brings, I understand that she is just a bridge. Yet there are times, even today, when she takes on a life of her own. I also notice that Patrick references God, and if he was a religious man from Ireland, it means that there are two choices, Catholic or Protestant. Thankfully, both are notorious record keepers. If he had attended a local congregation, there still might be a record. When I explain my plight to Father Muldowney, my own priest, he is happy to help. He promises to check surrounding cathedrals, as well as fax me a list of additional churches worth investigating. Next, I head out to see the city clerk. If Anna and the children move to San Francisco, there's a possibility that the family purchased a home. My chances are slim, but I'm getting desperate. The woman at the desk smiles a friendly hello, but if I expect her cheeriness to make my work pleasant, I am soon disappointed. The job is drudgery. 2 hours in, I discover a P. O'Reilly who owned property in Stonestown. But my hopes are dashed when further digging reveals he was Mr. Pierce O'Reilly, not Patrick, and dates on the documents preclude him from being my O'Reilly at all. After 6 more hours, I head home for a hot bath and bed, flush with frustration, needing to extinguish the feelings of failure building in my chest. On my way, a haunting comment from the journal keeps flashing into my head. It is a simple, almost reflective statement Patrick made in the journal's final pages. "It is interesting," he said, "that bridges, the most permanent of structures,
are so often built by the most transient of men. Is he speaking of himself? If bridge builders are migratory, if they follow the work, then did Patrick also move on to another bridge? If so, where? Once home, I find a government website that lists all of the bridges in the United States. My chest aches when I notice the number. 600,000. I narrow my search by filtering for large historic bridges. The Tacoma Narrows Bridge pops up first. It was a suspension bridge, the first to cross the Puget Sound, and construction began shortly after completion of the Golden Gate. Within minutes, however, I have dozens of possibilities. I see bridges in Connecticut, Pennsylvania, New York. I find bridges along the East Coast, the West Coast, and in between. They are everywhere. It doesn't take long for hopelessness to roll and boil, for the bleakness to bubble. I'm looking down another impossible road. Even if he moved on to work another bridge, the never-ending list on my monitor flickers a truth that bounces about the room. Patrick could have gone anywhere. Visiting churches should be soothing. Today, not so much. While some of the priests and ministers are pleasant, the rest must moonlight at the DMV. Several insist that I make an appointment. Not a problem, except it's for weeks down the road, and I can't wait weeks. At the churches friendly enough to let me peruse their records, I find the work grueling. It isn't like typing words into a search engine. Instead, the places are stuffy, the smell of must and mildew is overwhelming, and the rooms are miserably hot. Honestly, I envision hell to be quite like the back rooms of a church. Each page must be scrutinized individually, and the writing is nearly impossible to read. I start my quest with excitement, with a vision of success, but my enthusiasm ages into despair. I take a deep breath and remember that I need to be elastic and flexible like the bridge. But I don't feel elastic. I feel tense and rigid. I understand that this search is a self-imposed burden, one that I opted to carry the day I vowed to find the family of Patrick O'Reilly. And if it is self-imposed, then I should be able to cast it aside. But I can't. It has taken hold of me and won't let go. It has grown into an obligation that wraps its fingers around my heart. With each beat, I keep asking, what if, after all my searching, I can't find him? What if I never learn more about Patrick and Anna? I should go home. I haven't eaten since breakfast, and I can feel my blood sugars at an all-time low. Instead, with stress clouding my logic, I commit a cardinal sin. I pass Chang's Chinese Buffet, with its all-you-can-eat neon sign flashing like a hypnotist's trap. I wander inside, hand the plump Chinese woman my money, and then for the next 40 minutes, I perpetuate diet suicide. I eat like it's my last supper. I chow down on sesame chicken, sweet and sour pork, and orange beef. It's like popcorn. Once you start eating, it's almost impossible to stop. With everything fried in oil, I can eat through my entire monthly allowance of saturated fat in one sitting. I've always had the willpower to resist, but tonight I gorge like a screaming pig. By the time I can't pop another piece of fortune cookie into my mouth, all I desire is to crawl home and throw up. Not because I feel sick to my stomach, but because I feel sick in my heart. It's a deep-down sickness that I'm feeling because soon I'll be forced to admit that I have failed to find Patrick O'Reilly. In the safety of my home, I get angry. More than angry. I am livid. I scream at the computer. I crumple up papers and hurl them into the wastebasket. I move into the kitchen and swear at the stacks of books piled high, uttering words that I never say in public. All the while, my unfinished outline mocks from the table. I utterly detest that ridiculous assignment.
busy work from the society of ladies with too much time on their hands. I have been home for all of 5 minutes, and my pity party is in full swing. In my frustration, I move close to the table and dump the remaining pages of my report into the garbage can. As I do, I interrogate myself. Why is it, Katie, that you can't finish the report, can't find Patrick, can't accomplish anything you set out to do? Why is it that you're still alone? Why are you still stuck at a university, unable to move forward, too nervous to even face the man who betrayed you? Why, Katie? I ask as if I expect a different Katie to answer. But there is only one Katie at home, and her life is unraveling. As I wait for answers that don't come, I realize for the first time since walking through the door that I smell atrocious. I've worked up a sweat in the hot and stuffy church rooms, and the ensuing stench coming from my shirt is disgusting. I don't just stink with body odor. I reek of failure. In disgust, I tear off my shirt, head to the shower, and pull on the hot water. I'm usually one to conserve, to do my share for the community, but tonight I don't care. I plop down in the middle of the shower's tile floor and let the water cascade over me in torrents, watching it pool, mix and swirl with my guilt, and then flow down the drain. I vow to leave the water on until the pipes in the city run dry, until the conservation police kick down my door and haul me off naked and screaming to jail. After 30 minutes, however, my skin begins to shrivel. I renege on my vow to run the city dry, and decide instead that using up all the hot water in the house will be revenge enough. 10 minutes later, I am a prune, but the hot water keeps blasting. We have a deep, old-fashioned bathtub in the bathroom upstairs. Dad loved to soak in it after a hard day at the bridge. With an active teenage girl in the house, he would often run out of hot water. It drove him crazy until one Saturday, he brought home a new water heater, a huge 75-gallon model. Together, we connected it to our existing unit so that one feeds into the other. As my skin now starts to itch, it dawns on me that since that time, I don't remember running out of hot water. Ever. I could be here all night. I could drown. After 5 more minutes, I wave the white flag and push the valve closed in disgust. I am a failure at everything. My hands are white and wrinkled. I look like an old dead white woman. As I pat myself dry, my skin begins to scream for lotion, and there is none left in the bathroom. I want to simply crawl into bed naked and begin the cry of my life. And I will, just as soon as I get more lotion from the kitchen. I find the other bottle on the counter, but when I discover that it, too, is almost empty, I am about to start my tantrum over when something catches my attention. The notification light on my phone is blinking. Someone called while I was staging my shower sit-in. I tapped the screen to hear the voice of Gwen from the library. She must have called just before closing. I want to believe that this is the break I have been praying for. I need to hope. But as I consider my actions of the previous hour, caution seems my best ally. If I raise my expectations, I'll set myself up for a drop off the emotional edge that I just can't handle. But her words cause hope to rise in my chest. Hi, it's Gwen at the library. I think I may have found something.
Chapter 30. From Washington, D.C., Dave headed northwest on I-70 across Maryland and into Pennsylvania, past the steel mills of Pittsburgh, past factories, past apartments. I-70 soon meshed into I-76 toward Cleveland, then into I-80 past Lake Erie, Toledo, and Gary, Indiana. When Dave was hungry, he would stop and eat. Burgers and sandwiches, mostly. At drive-ins, cafes, fast-food diners. Whatever was convenient. When he was tired, he'd find a motel and sleep.
usually in the smaller towns, away from the big city, far from the memories he was trying to distance. Sometimes, when the monotony of the freeway began to grind, he'd exit to the back roads and traverse at a slower, less frenzied pace. Other times, when anxiety would take hold, when he worried about making it on time, he'd jump back onto the interstate and push it to the limit. Just missing Chicago, then across Illinois and into Iowa. Familiar city names. Davenport, Iowa City, Des Moines. But names that mixed and mingled, never letting him be sure, as he traced the route in his head, if they were places he'd just passed or those still to come. He drove by farms, endless fields of crops, scattered tractors and cows. He passed small, blurring towns, Guthrie, Oakfield, Hancock, almost nameless, each looking like the one before. Through them all, he kept a close eye on the weather, and it had generally cooperated. He detoured only once near Newton to avoid rain that was predicted to blow across the plain from the northeast. It was a detour that proved unnecessary. The guarded storm stayed distant, as if it understood that the determined man on the motorcycle needed to get past and be on his way. It was a solitary ride, a reflective ride, a lonely ride, and yet it provided time to think, to wonder. With Megan, things had been easy. Life's road had been busy, at times a veritable 8-lane freeway. But she had always been there providing a direction and a destination. Without her, it felt as though he'd lost his orientation. The once solid path was now more like gravel, and sometimes it led off into so many diverse directions that it was impossible to know which to choose. Or worse, at times the road ended, leaving only weeds, brush, and craggy rocks. Dave had hinted more than once to Dr. Jaspers that a change of scenery might do him some good. Her answer was always the same. I wish it were that easy to run away from the pain, David. If it were, I'd open up a travel agency. But it follows you. It chases you. The pain needs to be dealt with from inside, David, not from the outside. Was she right? Was this journey helping the inside? With each mile, the nagging questions remained. Was he avoiding his problems, or running toward the only place he could find answers? He had no idea. He simply knew that it was time he ran toward something. Past the state line and into Nebraska. More fast food, more cheap motels. Omaha, Lincoln, Aurora. Into the heartland. Kearney, Lexington, North Platte. Chased by demons. Perhaps chasing solace, but moving. If the constant riding was merely deadening the pain, one thing was certain. As soon as he stopped, as soon as the numbness wore thin, the returning ache would be devastating.
I arrive at the library just before 8 a.m. and wait by the entrance to the area that houses the special collections documents. Gwen doesn't arrive until almost 8 minutes after the hour. Hi, Katie. I had a feeling you'd be waiting. Sorry to be late. I couldn't find my keys. Without my keys, nobody gets in. That's okay. In your message, you said that you found something. Gwen nods as she fiddles with her large silver keyring. She locates the key and slips it back into the lock to open the door. I follow like a puppy. I checked the electronic index of the documents on loan to 3 universities. They didn't show a Patrick O'Reilly. I was about to call you and tell you the bad news when I remembered the interdepartment log sheets. From time to time, department heads can request that material be transferred to their care as long as they're using it on campus for an approved project. The problem is that those items on request don't show up on our loan sheets or in the electronic index until we get the confirmation logs back from the department heads. I remind myself that this is a university, So to someone obviously much smarter than I, the system must make perfect sense. Gwen continues, "Of course, it sometimes takes weeks. Heavens, I've seen them take months to be returned. So when I checked the log sheets, I could see that the chemistry lab had a bundle of letters that they've been using for date testing, items relating to the bridge. They're listed in the index as a bundle rather than by author. That's why nothing showed up. Anyway, I called Dr. Stanton, and apparently they did have a bundle of letters from the early to mid-1900s. Did have? They don't still have them? I question, getting impatient at the depth of her explanation. Not exactly. They were sent down to the extension in Los Angeles to Dr. Marcus, still technically part of the campus. I called his assistant, and she checked through the material. Sure enough, there was a letter that signed by... Are you ready? She pauses, as if expecting a drum roll to materialize from nowhere. When it doesn't, she finishes on her own. Patrick O'Reilly. Now, I don't know if it's the same Mr. O'Reilly you're looking for, but I thought you'd like to know. It was the best news I'd heard in weeks. How long will they have the letter? They're scheduled for another 2 months, longer if they request an extension. Can I drive down and see it? You can, but you don't need to. I had a copy sent over to me yesterday. I feel my neck chill as she turns to her desk and picks up 3 sheets of paper. I see the top piece has a sticky note attached with my name written on it. I glance at the first page and instantly recognize the handwriting. It is the same as in the journal. It is indeed a letter written by Patrick O'Reilly, my Patrick. This is amazing, Gwen. I owe you. Just doing my job. I hope it helps. I thank her again profusely, and then, as politely as possible, excuse myself to one of the nearby cubicles. It's not that I care if anyone else reads the letter. Obviously, many people have. I want to study the letter alone because it feels personal. Perhaps I'm also afraid of how I might react. February 11th, 1937. Dearest Anna, the bridge is almost finished, and she is a wonder. I can't wait for you and the young ones to see her. She spans a deep canyon, a channel filled with treacherous currents, and a perpetually frenzied sea, like the Atlantic that beats upon the shores of Ireland. The 2 great cables that drape from her towers contain enough strands of wire to encircle the equator thrice, and the concrete poured into her pylons and anchorages could pave a 4-foot-wide sidewalk from me to Dublin. The structure is indeed a wonder, and she will open to the public in just over 3 months. I could not help but feel a little pride today, Anna, as I walked her span. The wind was blowing, as it always does, and the gale caused me to remember the many days I had spent on her girders. At times, the wind would gust so hard, the bridge would sway back and forth nearly 5 times a man's height. I would think of you, even in those conditions. I would picture your smiling eyes, the warmth of your touch, your laughter. I would think of the children, and I would pray silently to God and the saints to sustain me. Only now, Anna, with me work almost complete, will I admit to you that it has been dangerous. 'Tis a job that loses 1 man for every $1 million spent. And yet, by God's good grace, only one had perished until February. The safety net had saved 19 men from plunging to their deaths into the cold, swirling sea. We called them members of the Halfway to Hell Club. Thank the saints I was not among them. Perhaps we took the net for granted until the day it failed. 12 lads were standing on the scaffolding when she collapsed. 11 fell into the net, and for but a moment the men cheered. Then the web began to tear, and screams of joy turned to terror. I watched in horror, Anna, as the web gave way,
and all of me friends plunged into the open jaws of the ocean below. 'Twas a tragic and painful day. The wonder is that only minutes before, I had stood on the same scaffolding. I do not tell you this to cause alarm. Me intentions are just the opposite. I want you to know, Anna, that it was God who spared me life. I have devoted 5 years to build her, 5 years of longing for you and the children. And though this bridge has robbed me of sacred years of fatherhood, she is also me savior. Without the endless days spent welding her frames together, I could never have saved the money needed to snatch you and the young ones out of the slums of Dublin that hold you captive. It is true, Anna. You will all soon be free. I have booked you all passage on the Virginia May, which sails from Cork on the 29th. I am enclosing $60 for the journey. Take only what you can carry. Leave quietly. Bid farewells carefully. I will spend me days waiting your arrival. And when you and the children come, there is something that I want all of us to do. We will take a boat across the bay to the north end of the bridge. We will hold hands, and with gratitude, we will walk as a family across her length, across our bridge to freedom. You will soon see that I don't exaggerate her greatness. I want you and the children to see her majesty, feel her power. I want our young ones to understand that she is more than just a bridge. She is our liberty, our life, our hope for the future. And not just for our family, but for all those who cross her span in search of better times. 'Tis true, God is good and merciful. And so when we reach the other side, I know a place on the south shore where we can kneel together as a family and say a prayer thanking Almighty God and all the saints for our reunion and our future. Anna, I hope you will not think it strange, but when we rise from our knees on that opposite shore, we will no longer be the O'Reilly family from the sully side of Dublin. At the moment we stand as a symbol of our new life, we will be the Rileys, and we will be from America. Please, dear wife, do not think that the sea air has rusted me brain. I'm not forsaking our heritage. We both know I'll be Irish till the day I die. But the children, Anna, the children will have a new life in America and a new hope. And not just our children, but their children, and then their children. And the chain will continue because of our courage and because of God's goodness. We have lived in poverty and misery, but soon it ends. The bridge is spectacular, enchanting, even magical. As we cross over the sea and to her opposite shore, we will be a family once again. I count the days. Your loving husband, Patrick O'Reilly. He changed his last name. No wonder my father couldn't find him. No wonder the man appeared to vanish. With tears clouding my eyes, I mouth my thanks to Gwen and hurry toward home. On my way out, I pass Professor Winston. I've always had a hard time hiding my emotions. I can't mask my joy when I'm happy, or my gloom when I'm sad. Right away, he sees tears streaming down my face, but he also recognizes that I am beaming. He's a man, so he is immediately confused.
Katie, are you okay?
Good morning, Professor. Yes, I'm fabulous. It's been such a productive morning.
But you've been crying.
Yes, indeed I have. His fingers touch his chin.
You certainly are involved in your work.
I smile and hurry past him toward the exit, and he doesn't once ask about the assignment. The day is turning out to be stellar after all. Chapter 31. Why do terrible days occur before wonderful days? Could it be with life that, in order to savor the joy, we must dine first at the table of despair?
I don't pretend to know. What I do know is that, as bad as the last several days have been, today has made up for them, and more. And no offense, God, but it's about time.